tablet was a piece of stone on which things were written and recorded, or a piece of wood, for example. So Imam Ja'far as-Sadiq alayhi salam called Imam Musa ibn Ja'far alayhi salam towards him and sat him on his lap and said to him, "My little son, write, you will meet from your enemy all kinds of tricks." Then Imam Ja'far as-Sadiq alayhi salam said to Imam Musa ibn Ja'far al-Kadhim alayhi salam, "Complete this saying." So Imam Musa ibn Ja'far alayhi salam, who again was just a small child at the time, he completed this saying in response to his father in this dialogue. Imam Musa ibn Ja'far al-Kadhim alayhi salam says, "If the enemy schemes and tricks against you, do not scheme and trick against him." Imam Ja'far as-Sadiq alayhi salam became incredibly happy at the wise statement of his son, and he was happy and proud of the talents and the genius of this young child, this child by the name of Musa ibn Ja'far alayhi salam. So Imam Ja'far as-Sadiq alayhi salam embraced Imam Musa ibn Ja'far, and showing his great admiration towards Musa ibn Ja'far alayhi salam, this divinely appointed Imam, this infallible Imam, this Ma'soom, said, "Offspring one of the other," which in the Arabic culture is a form of admiration and pride. Now, what do we take away from this statement and this beautiful conversation, which shows that one infallible Imam started a tradition, and then the second infallible Imam-to-be finishes this tradition, where Imam Ja'far as-Sadiq alayhi salam says, you will face all kinds of tricks, deceptions, schemes, plots from your enemy. And in reply, Imam Musa ibn Ja'far alayhi salam says that if the enemy schemes against you, they plot against you, they try to deceive you, they try to trick you, they try to, you know, manipulate you, which of course are all negative things. These are all the tools of the shayateen, the devils from among the men and the jinn, to use deception and to use trickery and evil schemes and evil plots and wicked plans. So if the enemy does this, Imam Musa ibn Ja'far alayhi salam says, that does not mean that we should do the same against the enemy. Meaning, as Muslims, we are not allowed to make evil plots against the enemy. We are not allowed to make wicked schemes against the enemy. We're not allowed to trick and deceive the enemy in negative and devilish, satanic terms. We are honest, we are honorable, we are sincere, we are truthful, we are just, we are noble. Just as the seventh divinely appointed Imam has taught us in these beautiful conversations, this is dialogue, Imam al-Kadhim alayhi salam.
Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of iRib English Radio, the program Dialogue. I'm Attar, the producer of this program, and at this moment I want you to listen to a shorter speech by Shaykh Abbas Mirza about Imam Musa al-Kadhim alayhi salam.
Imam Musa al-Kadhim alayhi salam, the seventh Shia Imam, is also known as Babul Hawa'ij, which means that the door to the desires and the hajat for us. This title became very famous for the Imam because of how he would attend to the people and respond to the people in Medina. It's been reported that Imam had two doors. One was a door was in the front and the door in the back. And usually the back door was always open to any time. Those whosoever have any need, have any desire, would attend to the Imam. And also it's been reported that after the sad martyrdom, after the sad shahada of the Imam, his chamber, his grave site, his shrine became the door of fulfillment of desires, and it stands as of today as well.
Thank you very much, dear listeners, for listening to this episode of Dialogue. Don't forget to visit our website at farstoday.com/EN, Call of Islam page, where you can find all of our previous programs and many others as well. Until another episode, fi amanillah, and God bless you all. أنت يا بدر المدينة خير خلق الله يا من قد جئت فينا
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/EN.
Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, wherever you are and wherever you are listening to us.
The keys of life.
Aqil Jawadi talks about the various keys of life and has brought about this book to be a companion for the very famous Mafatil Jinan, where one is a tool or the keys for paradise, and this book, of course, are the keys of life.
The Keys of Life, a program designed to tell you that what Islam gives you will help get you home with joy and faithfulness. So, well, listen to
The Keys of Life.
The world is a very, very big house, many people living in many rooms. We must open all the doors up, we must unlock them all today. Throw all the keys away.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم الحمد لله رب العالمين والصلاة والسلام على سيدنا محمد وآله الطاهرين.
My name is Sheikh Zaid Al Salami.
A few years ago, I started the course of wanting to commentate on a very important book that I believe is something that would be useful for everyone who reads it
and that is the book Mafatih al-Hayat, written by Ayatollah al-Uzma al-Sheikh Jawadi Amuli. Still in the area of discussing our social relationships with others, and one of the most important topics, I think, that is in this part of this very important book is al-islah dhat al-bayn, or reconciling between two people. In most cases, unfortunately, it's not between two people who are foreign to one another, but it's two people who have either lived a long life together or their blood relatives, their family members. And, you know, the worst thing for us to see in a society is for a father not to talk to his son, for a sister not to talk to her brother, for a husband to be in some kind of predicament with his wife, leading to a lot of tension or difficulties in the relationship. And that's exactly why this verse says, this is in Surah Al-Nisa, verse number 128. بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم وإن امرأة خافت من بعلها نشوزا. If a woman was to fear nushuz, hardship from her husband. Now nushuz here, you know, I'm not going to translate it as rebelling or renegading, because the ahkam with a wife being nashiza is different than the ahkam of a husband being nashiz. Can a husband be nashiz? Well, it's not based on his wajib obligation of tamkeen, which is the wife's obligation, but it's for something else. Here, in this case of a wife fearing some kind of rebellion from her husband, أو إعراضة, or dismissal, which pretty much means him neglecting her. Now, rebelling or rebellion here, or nushuz here from the husband's side, means that he has kind of abandoned her. He has somehow, unfortunately, got to a stage where he is mistreating her, not giving her her huquq. Aw i'rada, or he's just ignoring her or neglecting her. Fala junaha alayhima. This basically means that the wife should not treat him this same way. So if he is mistreating her, she should not be mistreating him. If he is neglecting her, she should not be neglecting him. So she doesn't do tit for tat, she doesn't deal with him the same way he is dealing with her. فَلَا جُنَاهَا عَلَيْهِمَا أَيْ يُصْلِحَ بَيْنَهُمَا. Here, it says that, well, besides the fact that what he's doing is wrong, but they should still try to reconcile. Why? Because in any case, وَالصُّلْحُ خَيْرٌ. In any case, sulh and finding peace and reconciliation will always be better. فَلَا جُنَاهَا عَلَيْهِمَا أَن يُصْلِحَا بَيْنَهُمَا صُلْحًا وَالصُّلْحُ خَيْرٌ. Subhanallah. In this one ayah, three times the word sulh has been used. وَالصُّلْحُ خَيْرٌ. I think that's a very important ending for the drama that happens between a wife and a husband. Not in defense of the husband, not in defense of the wife. Whoever is wrongfully mistreating the other, they, of course, are doing wrong, and they should be held, of course, accountable and responsible, but at the same time, it doesn't need to lead to the falling apart of the whole relationship. No, sulh is always going to be, al-islah is always going to be the best approach for all of this.
Ayatollah Jawadi Amuli, the author of the book Mafatih al-Hayat, The Keys of Life. This book, Mafatih, ought to be in two volumes.
یه جلدش هی مفاتیح جنان است چه فلون دماغ قصاب داره فلون روان است.
One volume, the present volume, Mafatihul Janan, is on the level of the lofty rewards for praying, fasting, etc.
یه جلدش کم داره و اینه که فلون درختکاری اینجا کم ثواب داره. دعا هم داره، ثواب هم داره.
But the book lacks its second volume, which ought to be on subjects like the lofty rewards for planting a tree.
امام اونطوری که رو گفته بودم گفته دی اون امامی که گفته اگر روزه بگیری ثواب داره همون امام گفته که اگر درخت بکاری و ثواب داره.
Imam has mentioned both of these subjects. The very Imam who has stressed out the reward for praying has also highlighted the reward for planting a tree. There are generous amounts of reward for protecting the environment. When growing wheat, take some in your hand and say these prayers. These are what the very Imam has mentioned. We lack this second volume in Islamic world.
In our Islamic teachings, we can see that there is utmost importance in al-islah dhatul bayn, in reconciling. And you know, there are in our Muslim communities, there are certain elders whose job, that's what they do. You know, their social job, not of course their employee job, their social job, which they see to be their moral and also religious obligation, is for them to try as much as they can to reconcile between each other. Imam Ali alayhi salam, when he was on his deathbed, having been struck by Abdul Rahman ibn Muljam, he brought all of his children together and he said, "Usikuma wa jami'a waladi wa ahli, advise you two, Hassan and Hussein, and all of my children and my family members, wa man balaghahu, and whoever hears this message." And whoever hears this message. And then he gives a few pieces of recommendation as far as his last testimony is concerned. SubhanAllah. This also shows how important it is. Imam Ali, salamullahi alayhi, on his deathbed. And this is the last thing that he says. وَصَلَاحِ ذَيْتَ بَيْنَكُمْ فَإِنِّي سَمِعْتُ جَدَّكُمَا. And for you to reconcile between people, because I heard your grandfather يقول فإني سمعت جدكما رسول الله صلى الله عليه وآله يقول صلاح ذات البين, reconciling between people, أفضل من عامة الصلاة والصيام, is better than all your life of praying and fasting. الحمد لله رب العالمين. والصلاة والسلام على سيدنا محمد وآله الطاهرين.
Driving past, walking fast to the field of dreams, hear the children's screams.
There was the Keys of Life by Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran, IRIB English Radio.
Every corner represents a different image in my mind. A momentary emotion, space spent in time, in time. Memories fade like a dusty windowpane, and you can't see your past no more. The only thing that remains is that feeling of warmth in your heart, there will always be there, be there.
In the limelight. The New York Attorney General, Letitia James, said on Monday, 20th of December, her investigation of Donald Trump's business affairs would continue undeterred, despite Trump suing to stop it on grounds of political bias, because no one is above the law, not even someone with the name Trump. The article you're about to hear has been written by The Guardian columnist Martin Pengelly. The piece is titled, New York Attorney General Vows Trump Investigation Will Proceed Undeterred. New York Attorney General Letitia James said on Monday, 20th of December, her investigation of Donald Trump's business affairs would continue undeterred, despite Donald Trump suing to stop it on grounds of political bias, because no one is above the law, not even someone with the name Trump. The New York Times first reported Trump's lawsuit filed in federal court in Syracuse, New York. It alleges that Letitia James, a Democrat, is guided solely by political animus and a desire to harass, intimidate, and retaliate against a private citizen who she views as a political opponent. Letitia James is investigating whether the Trump Organization manipulated valuations of its real estate properties. In one such instance, as Donald Trump ran for president in 2016, The Guardian reported on different valuations of a golf club outside of New York City. The headline, How Trump's $50 million golf club became $1.4 million when it came time to pay tax. The Washington Post and other media outlets have also reported similar alleged practices at other Trump properties. Last year, investigators working for Letitia James interviewed Eric Trump, one of former president's sons and a Trump Organization executive. Letitia James went to court to enforce a subpoena, and a judge forced the younger Trump to testify after his lawyers cancelled the deposition. In an investigation that could only result in civil charges, Letitia James recently said she would seek to question Donald Trump under oath. It is rare for law enforcement agencies to issue a civil subpoena for testimony from a person also the subject of a related criminal investigation, partly because the person could simply cite their Fifth Amendment right to remain silent. It is unlikely that Trump's lawyers would allow him to be deposed unless they were sure his testimony could not be used against him in a criminal case. Donald Trump's business and tax affairs are also the subject of a criminal investigation run by the Manhattan District Attorney, Cyrus Vance, which has been in progress for more than 3 years. Letitia James joined that investigation in May of this year. The Manhattan case includes a focus on whether the Trump Organization overstated the value of some real estate assets to obtain loans and tax benefits. In their lawsuit against Letitia James, who recently announced a run for governor of New York before stepping back, Trump and the Trump Organization claimed the Attorney General has violated their rights under the U.S. Constitution by pursuing a politically motivated investigation. Donald Trump and the company pointed to public statements that Letitia James made before she was elected as Attorney General. The lawsuit also made a plainly political play of its own, echoing Trump's language in office and on the campaign trail when it said, rather than diligently prosecuting actual crimes in the state of New York, which are steadily on the rise, James has instead allocated precious taxpayer resources towards a frivolous witch hunt. Donald Trump and the Trump Organization are seeking a court order barring the investigation from going forward. In a statement, Trump's attorney, Alina Haber, said, by filing this lawsuit, we intend to not only hold her accountable for her blatant constitutional violations, but to stop her bitter crusade to punish her political opponent in its tracks. In her own statement, Letitia James said, "The Trump Organization has continually sought to delay our investigation into its business dealings, and now Donald Trump and his namesake company have filed a lawsuit as an attempted collateral attack on that investigation." To be clear, neither Donald Trump nor the Trump Organization get to dictate if and where they will answer for their actions. Our investigation will continue undeterred, because no one is above the law, not even someone with the name Trump. The New York Attorney General, Letitia James, also noted that in August of 2020, she filed a motion to compel the Trump Organization to provide documents and testimony from multiple witnesses regarding several specific Trump Organization properties and transactions. Since then, the court has ruled in Attorney General James's favor multiple times. Last month, Donald Trump's former lawyer and fixer, Michael Cohen, who served a 3-year sentence for offenses including campaign finance violations relating to a payoff to Stormy Daniels, who claims an affair with Donald Trump, was asked about the prospect of Trump being indicted in the criminal investigation in Manhattan. Michael Cohen said he was confident that prosecutors could indict Donald Trump tomorrow if they really wanted to, and they could be successful. Asked if he was confident, "You did help Donald Trump commit crimes," Michael Cohen told NBC. "I can assure you that Donald Trump is guilty of his own crimes. Was I involved in much of the inflation and deflation of his assets? The answer to that question is yes." In July, the longtime Trump Organization Chief Financial Officer Alan Weisselberg pleaded not guilty to criminal charges in what a prosecutor in Cyrus Vance's office called a sweeping and audacious 15-year tax fraud.
The wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the newsline.
London Breed, mayor of San Francisco, has declared a state of emergency in the drug-infested neighborhood of Tenderloin to clean up what she called its nasty streets. The district has long been known for the number of homeless people, drug users, and drug dealers on the streets. Breed believes this state of emergency would disrupt the illegal activity in the neighborhood and get people the treatment and support they need. London Breed's announcement broke with the liberal tradition and exposed the extent of the crisis plaguing the city's streets. But San Francisco isn't the only city reeling from violence and drugs. More than 100,000 Americans died this year from drug overdoses. The situation has become so dire that U.S. President Joe Biden signed an executive order last week to fight organized crime networks whose actions are impacting the country's public health.
The overreach of the government dictates what families can do when it comes down to disciplining their children and all of that. So now you see generations having passed without any type of structure. The family is decaying. And of course, this is something that is touted on the news wave, media, all of those different things. It's a consistent thing where families are being denigrated.
In the meantime, Cities across the U.S. are setting their all-time high records for homicides, most of which involving firearms. The Texas city of Austin, for example, where gun control is lax, has reported 88 homicides in 2021, eclipsing the previous high of 59 that was reported in 1984. Austin is among the 9 cities that have broken their homicide records. The case in point is that they are not concentrated, but are all scattered around the U.S. map. Stores across the U.S. have increasingly been coming under raids by mobs who have been collecting tens of thousands of dollars worth of cash and goods in recent weeks. Although most of the ransacked high-end stores are located in the U.S. state of California, similar incidents have been taking place elsewhere in the country too. Police statistics show that theft and larceny have been up about 88% compared to last year, with the overall crime rate standing at almost 52% higher in 2021. A recent study suggests that the crime rate in the underprivileged areas has jumped much higher compared to wealthier districts in the first 5 months of the coronavirus pandemic. Law enforcement officials reject the idea that the rise in the so-called smash-and-grab attacks has to do with the COVID-19 pandemic. Instead, they believe the police's permissive attitude toward theft and the holiday season have been the factors pushing the numbers.
And of course, this lawlessness is a result of things that are unjust, things that continue to happen, and righteous judgment is not being implemented or instituted. And so also to add to that, it's a departing of the morality, the values and everything that this country was supposed to have espoused 2 years ago that's been changed.
Some also believe law enforcement's lack of resources has forced the police to deprioritize theft, while others blame a lack of political will to fight such offenses. All indications are suggesting that the current crime rates in the U.S. are likely to become a new normal.
An investigation into the confidential files of the U.S. military has revealed a shocking truth about the American air war in West Asia. The New York Times says it has reviewed over 1,300 documents from a hidden Pentagon archive. The report has shed more light on how the U.S. undercounted thousands of civilian deaths caused by its deeply flawed intelligence and faulty targeting in Iraq, Syria, and Afghanistan. According to the military's count, over 1,600 civilians, many of them children, have died in U.S. air operations in Iraq, Syria, and Afghanistan. And even though the Times does not give a figure, it does say that the military has drastically undercounted the tally. The U.S. has a history of conducting similar strikes in Somalia, Libya, Yemen, and Pakistan out of the spotlight without accepting any responsibility while destroying the lives of civilians. New research from a London-based civilian harm monitoring group, Air Wars, showed that since 2001, at least 22,600 civilians were killed in U.S. strikes across various theaters, including Afghanistan, Iraq, Syria, Somalia, Libya, Yemen, and Pakistan. The group said that the number of civilian deaths could be potentially as high as 48,000. The documents show that the U.S. forces conducted more than 50,000 airstrikes in Iraq, Syria, and Afghanistan over a 5-year period. The majority of strikes were carried out without prior plans. The report also brings into question the Pentagon's claims of transparency and accountability. Based on the report, only a few assessments of faulty raids have been made public, and surprisingly, none have found any wrongdoing or led to disciplinary action. The U.S. military, from the terrorist CENTCOM to the Department of Defense, does not provide official estimates of civilian deaths, nor have they published such findings. They simply kill civilians and rarely offer compensation.
The lack of accountability, even in the way in which these crimes are being revealed, shows that this is accepted within the political establishment of the U.S. government today. And it has been, when you look at past wars and the incredible number of civilian casualties.
In its report, the New York Times reviewed cases in which civilians were killed, none of which resulted in an admission of wrongdoing. The report says poor or inadequate surveillance footage often contributed to deadly targeting failures. Most recently, 10 people were killed in a U.S. drone strike in the Afghan capital, Kabul. Washington initially claimed to have targeted terrorists, but later it was revealed that all the victims were civilians, including 7 children. Washington was forced to admit that the attack had been a tragic mistake, taking civilian lives. But eventually, it decided that no one would be punished for the erroneous strike. Also, the New York Times says it has visited nearly 100 casualty sites in Iraq, Syria, and Afghanistan and interviewed scores of survivors to compile the report. Even though many civilian survivors now have to live with disabilities that require expensive treatment, only fewer than a dozen have received compensation.
Well, just to say, it's also important to recognize that the only people who've ever been prosecuted for the drone strikes are those who revealed that drone strikes were going on and that they were targeting civilians. I'm speaking about Daniel Hale, now in prison for exposing U.S. civilian strikes, Julian Assange. There's a refusal to hold anyone accountable.
The U.S. has kept killing civilians with impunity and without accountability in various theaters. It also suppresses the leaked information about crimes it committed in those countries. For instance, its efforts to punish the WikiLeaks founder, Julian Assange, who caused Washington great embarrassment by disclosing confidential military and diplomatic records in 2010. These documents included classified military and diplomatic information, detailing U.S. bombing campaigns in Afghanistan and Iraq, information about civilian deaths, and secret U.S. drone strikes in Yemen in face of American officials' denial. His case proves that Washington fears its misdeeds being revealed again. Scores of Palestinians have been injured by Israeli settlers in villages around the city of Nablus in the occupied West Bank following a shooting near an illegal outpost in Homesh that left one settler dead and 2 wounded. Dozens of Israeli settlers attacked Qaryut village south of Nablus overnight. The attackers broke into many homes in the town and assaulted local families. Scores of Palestinians were injured in the process and moved to several hospitals in Nablus. According to the Palestinian media, the settlers also blocked the main highway connecting Nablus and Ramallah and attacked vehicles with Palestinian license plates with stones, causing damages to several cars. In reaction to the attacks, the Palestinian Ministry of Foreign Affairs and Expatriates called on the United Nations to promptly activate the international protection system for Palestinian civilians under Israeli occupation. It also called on the international community to pressure the Israeli regime into stopping acts of terrorism committed by settlers against Palestinians and their communities. The ministry held the regime of Israeli Prime Minister Naftali Bennett fully and directly responsible for settler violence and terror, and warned against the dangerous repercussions of their acts on the status of the region. It is stressed that Israeli authorities are encouraging and protecting settler violence, which is soaring on a daily basis. According to Israeli advocacy group B'Tselem, 2021 saw a rise in settler violence of 28.6% compared to last year. UN human rights experts have expressed alarm at the rising rate of violence directed by Israeli settlers toward Palestinians in the occupied Palestinian territory. According to the United Nations Office for the Coordination of the Humanitarian Affairs, already in the first 10 months of 2021, there have been 410 attacks by settlers against Palestinians. 4 Palestinians were killed by settlers this year. Nearly 700,000 Israelis live in over 230 settlements built since the 1967 occupation of the Palestinian territories of the West Bank. All the settlements are illegal under international law, and the United Nations Security Council has condemned the settlement activities in several resolutions. Since occupying the West Bank, Israel has misappropriated more than 200,000 hectares of land there for its own purposes, including building and expanding settlements and paving roads for settlers. Some areas have been taken over by the regime issuing military orders, others through daily acts of settler violence. These two seemingly unrelated tracks are both forms of state violence. The Israeli apartheid regime and its representatives actively aid and abet the settlers' violence as part of his strategy to cement the takeover of Palestinian land.
The settlers and the uniformed soldiers work together, not without tensions, but they always support each other, and the settlers are used to carry out the particular kinds of attacks, burning trees, certain kinds of terror attacks, which the army prefers not to do. They shoot, they kill, but they protect the settlers 100% of the time. The settlers know this, and it gives them a sense of complete impunity.
Last week, the U.S. Undersecretary of State Victoria Nuland and an Israeli minister who is responsible for police discussed the increase in settler violence against Palestinians. That drew rebukes from pro-settlement ministers and right-wing opposition lawmakers within the Israeli regime. Omer Bar-Lev later pushed back his critics, saying they were having difficulty looking in the mirror and that settler violence has become an issue on the international stage. But Israel's Prime Minister, Naftali Bennett, jumped in to say it's just a marginal issue. In a tweet on Tuesday, he noted that there are marginal elements in every community, and they should be dealt with using all means. But we must not generalize about an entire community. The Combatants for Peace group, which brings together Israeli and Palestinian victims of violence, condemned Bennett for his Tuesday comments, charging that the Prime Minister had given full backing to depraved settler violence, which has reached new heights under his watch. The group added that Bennett gave a green light to the Wild West atmosphere in the territories. Also, an interview published on Wednesday revealed what Israeli Foreign Minister thinks about this issue. He told an American periodical earlier this month that extremist violence is a stain on Israel amid a noted rise in violent attacks by Israeli settlers against Palestinians.
There is a situation in the West Bank which is lawless. You might consider the situation to be one of no legal protection for Palestinians whatsoever.
Bennett's marginalization of the issue was aimed at legitimizing and praising settler violence, which is soaring on a daily basis. Let's not forget that Israeli soldiers and police usually defend the attackers or simply stand to the side when they assault Palestinians. Therefore, settler violence is a central issue that requires urgent attention from the international community to put an end to it.
Morgan, Helen Margaret Lillian, Liberal Democrats, 17,957.
In another setback for the British Prime Minister Boris Johnson, his Conservative Party has lost its North Shropshire seat to Liberal Democrats in a by-election, the constituency the Tories dominated for nearly 200 years. In her victory speech, Helen Morgan said the results reflect the British people's views about the Conservative Party.
Tonight, the people of North Shropshire have spoken on behalf of the British people. They've said loudly and clearly, Boris Johnson, the party is over.
The Liberal Democrats, in my view, have never been an alternative to the Conservative Party. They're really there's very little difference between the policies of the Liberal Democrats and Conservatives. In other words, when the Conservatives lose credibility, they bring out the Liberal Democrats who are sort of centrist, never represented any concrete or coherent alternative to the Conservative Party.
Conservative lawmaker Roger Gale also says the by-election can be regarded as a referendum on the Prime Minister's performance. The by-election was called after the former MP for North Shropshire stepped down for breaching the Parliament's paid lobbying rules. The British government tried to avert the resignation by changing the rules, but later faced a backlash and was forced to backtrack. That was only one in the long list of issues raising questions about Boris Johnson's leadership. Opposition politicians accused Johnson of being a serial liar and incompetent leader, with some demanding that he resign.
Clearly, the vote in North
Shropshire.
Boris Johnson acknowledged that the shocking results of the North Shropshire by-election contained a message for him and his party.
I'm responsible for everything that the government does, and of course I take personal responsibility.
But there's too much responsibility to shoulder, as Boris Johnson's tenure has been replete with a spate of allegations and scandals. The Premier stands accused of breaking the law by using Conservative Party donations to renovate his residence at No. 11 Downing Street. He's also under pressure for reported parties in his office last Christmas, disregarding the very COVID-19 restrictions the government had imposed. British dailies The Guardian and The Independent have also reported that Boris Johnson himself joined a pizza party in Downing Street in May last year amid the first nationwide lockdown. Obviously, the Premier is also under fire for his handling of the pandemic. On Tuesday, he suffered a humiliating rebellion from Conservative lawmakers over measures to curb the spread of the Omicron variant of the coronavirus. In addition, damaging disclosures have surfaced about some of the Conservative MPs who've moonlighted as political consultants or advisors, raking in tens of thousands of pounds by lobbying. The metaphorical pendulum in Britain's domestic politics appears to be swinging to the other side. The Conservatives have a couple of years to stop that from happening.
Is there any other way to get familiar with Islam besides mainstream media? Try IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en. Thank you.
in the limelight.
Shortly before 3 a.m. on 19th of July 2016, American Special Operations Forces bombed what they believed were three ISIS staging areas on the outskirts of Tukhar, a riverside hamlet in northern Syria. They reported 85 fighters killed. In fact, they hit houses far from the front line, where Syrian farmers and their families and other local people sought nighttime sanctuary from bombing and gunfire. More than 120 Syrian civilians and villagers were killed in that bombing. The article you're about to hear has been written by the New York Times journalist Azmat Khan. The piece is titled, "Hidden Pentagon Records Reveal Patterns of Failure in Deadly Airstrikes." In early 2017 in Iraq, an American warplane struck a dark-colored vehicle believed to be a car bomb, stopped at an intersection in the Wadi Hajar neighborhood of West Mosul. Actually, the car had been bearing not a bomb, but a man named Majid Mahmoud Ahmad, his wife, and their two children, who were fleeing the fighting nearby. They and three other Iraqi civilians were killed. In November of 2015, after observing a man dragging an unknown heavy object into an ISIS defensive fighting position, American forces struck a building in Al-Ramadi in Iraq. A military review found that the object was actually a person of small stature, very probably a child, who died in the airstrike. None of these deadly failures resulted in a finding of wrongdoing. These cases are drawn from a hidden Pentagon archive of the American air war in the Middle East since 2014. The trove of documents, the military's own confidential assessments of more than 1,300 reports of civilian casualties obtained by the New York Times, lays bare how the air war has been marked by deeply flawed intelligence, rushed and often imprecise targeting, and the deaths of thousands of civilians, many of them children, a sharp contrast to the American government's image of war waged by all-seeing drones and precision bombing. The documents show, too, that despite the Pentagon's highly codified system for examining civilian casualties, pledges of transparency and accountability have given way to opacity and impunity. In only a handful of cases were the assessments made public. Not a single record provided includes a finding of wrongdoing or of disciplinary action. Fewer than a dozen condolence payments were made, even though many survivors were left with disabilities requiring expensive medical care. Documented efforts to identify root causes or lessons learned are very rare. The air campaign represents a fundamental transformation of warfare that took shape in the final years of the Obama administration, amid the deepening unpopularity of the forever wars that had claimed more than 6,000 American service members' lives. The United States traded many of its boots on the ground for an arsenal of aircraft directed by controllers sitting at computers, often thousands of miles away. President Barack Obama called it the most precise air campaign in history. This was the promise. America's extraordinary technology would allow the military to kill the right people while taking the greatest possible care not to harm the wrong ones. For years, American air power was crucial to the beleaguered Afghan government's survival. And as U.S. combat deaths dwindled, the faraway wars and their civilian death tolls receded from most American sights and minds. On occasion, stunning revelations have pierced the silence. A New York Times investigation found that a Kabul drone strike in August of this year, which American officials said had destroyed a vehicle laden with bombs, had instead killed 10 members of an Afghan family. The New York Times recently reported that dozens of civilians had been killed in a 2019 bombing in Syria that the military had hidden from public view. That strike was ordered by a top-secret strike cell called Talon Anvil that, according to people who worked with it, frequently sidestepped procedures meant to protect civilians. Talon Anvil executed a significant portion of the air war against ISIS in Syria. The Pentagon regularly publishes bare-bones summaries of civilian casualty incidents, and it recently ordered a new high-level investigation of the 2019 airstrike in Syria. But in the rare cases where failings are publicly acknowledged, they tend to be characterized as unfortunate, unavoidable, or uncommon. In response to questions from the New York Times, Captain Bill Urban, the spokesman for the U.S. Central Command, said, "Even with the best technology in the world, mistakes do happen, whether based on incomplete information or misinterpretation of the information available, and we try to learn from those mistakes." Captain Bill Urban added, "We work diligently to avoid such harm. We investigate each credible instance, and we regret each loss of innocent life." He described minimizing the risk of harm to civilians as a strategic necessity, as well as a legal and moral imperative, driven by the way these casualties are used to feed the ideological hatred espoused by our enemies in the post-9/11 conflicts and supercharge the recruitment of the next generation of extremists. Yet, what the hidden Pentagon documents show is that civilians have become the regular collateral casualties of a way of war gone badly wrong. To understand how this happened, the New York Times did what military officials admit they have not done: analyzed the casualty assessments in aggregate to discern patterns of failed intelligence, decision-making, and failed execution. It also visited more than 100 casualty sites and interviewed scores of surviving residents and current and former American officials. Taken together, the reporting offers the most sweeping and also the most granular portrait of how the air war was prosecuted and investigated, and its civilian death toll. There is no way to determine the full death toll, but one thing is certain: it is far higher than the Pentagon has so far acknowledged. According to the military's count, 1,417 civilians have died in airstrikes in the campaign against ISIS in Iraq and Syria. Since 2018 in Afghanistan, U.S. air operations have killed at least 188 Afghan civilians. But the New York Times analysis of the documents found that many allegations of civilian casualties had been summarily discounted with scant evaluation, and the underground reporting involving a sampling of cases dismissed, cases deemed credible, and in Afghanistan, cases not included in the trove of Pentagon documents, found hundreds of deaths uncounted. The so-called war of precision did not promise that civilians would not die, but before an airstrike is approved, the military must undertake elaborate protocols to estimate and avoid civilian harm. Any expected civilian casualties must be proportional to the military advantage gained, and America's precision bombs are indeed precise. They hit their targets with near unerring accuracy. The documents, along with the New York Times' ground reporting, illustrate that many often disastrous ways that the military's predictions of the peril to civilians turn out to be wrong. Their lessons are rarely learned. These breakdowns of intelligence and surveillance occur over and over again. Repeated